This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by www.starktruthradio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can read his articles and find out more on robertstark.substack.com.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with Matt Pegas, and we're going to be discussing his new book, The Black Album. Matt Pegas, great speaking to you about this.
Correct. Yes. Thank you for having me on, and thank you for checking out the book. Obviously, Robert, we have done so many podcasts together. Most recently, we did a simulcast with my podcast and yours. People have heard us talk many times, but this one's obviously special because it's actually a book I read. And as always, I appreciate you for having me on. And if people out there are a fan of both yours and mine, and I suspect there remains plenty of overlap, this should be a good show.
So it's a collection of short stories. It's not a novel, and broader themes include internet culture, masculinity, alienation, alchemy, occultism, and aesthetics. Yeah. And it sort of feels like a series of journal entries, actually, but is the inspiration from the Beatles' White Album, and what are some overall inspirations? Also, first of all, reference the significance of the title, The Black Album, and then also what inspired you to write this?
Yeah, no, I could kind of chart a whole web of things. The White Album, Beatles influence is fairly indirect, but it is there. I guess from the get-go, so it's this trope in music to release an album either literally called the such-and-such color album or just release an album that's of that color that later gets referred to that. The Beatles' White Album was not originally supposed to be called the White Album. I think it was technically just called the Beatles, and people started to refer to it as the White Album, and that probably started the trope of doing this. Since then, we've gotten... there's only one White Album, but there's been several Black Albums in the world of music, such as Metallica's, Jay-Z's, Prince's. It's not really referred to this, but in Spinal Tap, of course, there's an all-Black album. Kanye West more recently released an all-Black album. It's just kind of a standard music thing to do. And it'd be kind of interesting to speculate as to what that instinct is. I always viewed it for musicians, as well as for myself with this book, is just kind of this desire to not minimalism in an IKEA way, but a desire to just present something really simple. Because, there's so much maximalism sometimes in music album cover. The Beatles being a good example, you have Sgt. Pepper, and I believe that's actually followed by the White Album. So you take something that's very maximalist and then you instead go for something very minimalist. It's just there's something pure in just, I guess, going for that, or maybe in certain instances, even people have released albums like that due to, in the parodic world of Spinal Tap, but I think this has probably also happened in real life. Sometimes it's like you want to go for something, it doesn't work out, and you're like, screw it, I'm just going to do a black cover. There's a lot of symbolism you could read into in that. In the literary world, the only obvious example of this I can think of is Joan Didion's The White Album, which I'm not pretending to be as good of a writer as Joan Didion, and Lord knows I'm not another one of these LA hipster writers who is trying to be Joan Didion. However, it is a collection of essays. I'm definitely referencing Joan Didion with that, as did Brett Easton Ellis with his more recent collection of essays, which he just called White, which was a reference to the White Album. So I'm kind of working in that both musical and literary tradition. And the book is laid out, the table of contents, there's a side A and a side B. There's a little bit of a record sort of theme, not dissimilar to where our friend Adam was reading Specs, mixtape Hyperborea, kind of modeling out for a mixtape. We did this both independently, but, it's a fun idea to kind of bring these musical and essayistic worlds together. And the last thing I'll say about this is, And people have pointed this out on Twitter, and I'm quite proud of the sort of dual comparison. There's a Death in June album. It's not called a Black Album. It's called The World That Summer. But the cover of this book is based pretty heavily off of that Death in June album, because it is, at the end of the day, not just simply a black cover, but has two symbols enclosed in circles, which is a direct mimicking of Death in June's The World That Summer.
Yeah, a big theme is Alienation, the incel issue, but like also mass shooters and serial killers. And you referenced that girl who went on a mass shooting in the 70s. I don't like Mondays.
Yeah.
You referenced the Las Vegas shooter Paddock, and you referenced Charles Manson. You referenced Elliot Rodgers. You might reference a lot of different serial killers, and the preference, you ask like the questions why mass shooters occur, how one goes down this path, and similar themes in your novel Dragon Day, but also
very much
even like my novel Vaporfornia and Journey to Vapor Island, or Andy Nowicki's Columbine Pilgrim.
Yeah.
And you have the preference by James Nowick. And what James Nowick said is young men have nothing to aspire to, no room to dream. Our society is a hollowed out husk, corrupt elites with zero sense of noblesse oblige to the people, the joy of life being distinguished. So he's not at all surprised. I mean, it's no mystery to him, and you would agree.
Yeah.
But basically, I think what is notable about these individuals, not so much serial killers, but more with mass shooters, is their target is more society at large or the institutions.
Yeah, totally, I would go even further, but keep going. Sorry.
Personify like their individual victims.
Yeah, they personify their individual victims. So there's that political interpretation you can have, and that's always been
like,
interesting to me.
It's not really some like mystery, like it's not some mystery or conspiracy theory. Like there's a lot of conspiracy theories about the Las Vegas shooting.
Yeah.
You say it's not really a mystery.
Yeah.
But
conspiracy theories,
what society and the media really gets wrong about these mass shooters.
Yeah, is the need to pin a reason to all of them, which is a natural human desire to know what really happened. And I like and I'm interested in conspiracy theories as much as the next guy. And certainly Vegas is shrouded in mystery. But, you know, as is said in that journal entry, which I always have to have the caveat, you know, it is technically fictional, that part the character portrayed, even though it is a journal entry, even though the character seems to bear my name. Yeah, that he basically says it's no real mystery to him. And the point I want to make with it is, even though, with Elliot Rodger, with Charles Manson, with all of them, there's always an interesting thing. There's always oftentimes, and even like Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, serial killers give us insights, you know, in a dark way, but insights nonetheless into certain social issues or psychological problems that may beset certain people in certain times. That stuff's interesting. But I think on a more fundamental level, these things are responses to this underlying nihilism in society that we're all acquainted with and that really needs no explanation. Like it's not, you know, I'm reminded, and some would find this cringe, I believe it's a Jordan Peterson quote where he says, you know, the mass shooter is fundamentally lashing out against reality itself. It's a very Gnostic notion or God perhaps of lashing out about against an existence that is itself intolerable, and which you can always hang some political, you know, decline of the West or you can always blame people for it, and maybe some of that is valid, the kind of misery young men may feel. But I also think there is that Gnostic spiritual protest against reality element to it, which I tie in also with the some of the more Buddhist themes of self-mummification that rear their heads. The act of I'm not going to pronounce my East Asian languages here, but the Buddhist self-mummification image that recurs to the book to me is like the more passive and spiritually, you know, non-harmful response to an existence that is intolerable. And then the mass shooting thing is more, you know, the destructive way of sort of doing that. Does this make sense what I'm saying? I also find it in these recent people who've set themselves on fire. You know, it's this, whenever these things happen, it's like, yes, you can point to mental health. You can point to political reasons why people got from there here to there. But at core, these things are a spiritual malady that we see. You know, it is always young men, right?
Responding to. As far as to say it's a metaphysical issue beyond just, even people in our sphere rely upon cliche. Some people will say, oh, they'll have a reductionist opinion. Yeah. Some people will automatically say it's the incel issue, or they'll automatically say it's economic neoliberalism. There's all these like kind of.
Yeah. And these the book gets into political issues, certainly, and even the incel issue to an extent. They're not irrelevant. I just think even those things, even the existence of neoliberalism, the sexual marketplace.
It's a lack of meaning, and there's a metaphysical angle to it.
Yeah, yeah, and it's chicken or the egg. You know what aspects of political, sociopolitical reality cause metaphysical problems, and what aspects of metaphysical problems lead to sociopolitical realities. It's chicken or the egg. You can't totally separate them. But whatever the issue is, it's deeper than any one or even any one network of issues. It's something deeper that I think is still within the realm of the unconscious, which is why in many respects, even though the book is, and there's the second half, as you kind of acknowledge, is nonfiction, and it's written in my own voice, but the nonfiction is paired with the fiction for a reason. And that's because I think there's what I can only describe as a Lovecraftian sort of horror behind this stuff. And I still think we can only best describe using fiction and looking to people like Lovecraft, because the mere sociopolitical description of the problems doesn't quite do it justice.
So yeah, there is a story. It's sort of like a journal entry. There's actually two separate stories. There's one story where you write yourself in as a serial killer and you're found dead out in the desert near Amboy. And it's basically fiction. It's fiction about yourself as a serial killer. So I think that's important to clarify, because some people might take it the wrong way. But sort of inspired by esoteric Buddhism and MKUltra. And it kind of the stuff from like that show we did on Malibu Road.
Yes.
About being part of an MKUltra experiment. Then you reference certain sites like UCLA and Westside Pavilion in the 80s. And that's one story. And then there's another story where you're up at 3 a.m. on Christmas morning contemplating about Paddock. And then Stephen Paddock, and you go to Vegas where you talk about it's because you're writing about yourself and you're contemplating carrying out some kind of act. And again, it's just fiction in case anyone's listening.
Well, it is just fiction.
The character
they
visit the gun store. I think it's in Burbank where Elliot Rodger purchased his gun.
Yeah.
And there's some contemplation of what someone would go through, like the emptiness that they're planning an act. But it's to clarify, not that the author has that potential with a question mark, but is actually true. Like, did you go to Vegas and did you get blocked from visiting Mandalay Bay Suite?
No. Not at all. I did once consider going to walk by the room, and then I kind of decided against it. I do think it's closed, but no, that's all fiction, really. It's
but why did you choose to sort of write it as yourself?
Good question.
Is this a sort of like Jungian shadow self, like you're talking about, that kind of dark subconscious side of you?
Yeah, it's definitely the Jungian shadow self thing at work. And then I don't know if this is the sexiest answer, but on some level it's I'm not a full-time writer, sadly, and writing for me, as for many people who work or who have other things in their life that they have to attend to, it's like you kind of just write in that hour before work or after work, and you just kind of write what you feel. And I write a decent amount of nonfiction. That's great, but I also have this bug, to write fiction. And what ends up coming out of me, due to time limitations, ends up being something that's sort of close to me. So be it. And I could have.
Because, to create, a grand, elaborate, plot and narrative, that really requires a lot of time and energy.
Yeah, which I don't want to sound lazy, but it's like I also just want to keep writing and keep doing this in a therapeutic way. And, maybe I should have just added just a few other layers of, through a few other filters, different names. But, of course, there's also something I don't mean
to
say.
But I do this in my book, too. I always think about, what could have. Should I go back and edit stuff? But you just sort of, what should I have written in it differently? And what could you have improved upon? You just sometimes with writing, you just have to kind of let it go.
You do. And also I'll add, I don't know, I'm not well versed in sort of the theory here, but there's this writer, David Shields, who I haven't read many of his books, but he sort of talks about how, it's harder for people to sort of, people read fiction less and less, and people write fiction less and less. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but I think one of them is it's harder. I don't know why, maybe because we're overstimulated with the internet, and there's so much self-narrativizing that goes on anyway on the internet. It's kind of harder to really create and invite people to enter into these fictional worlds. And sometimes it's more interesting or just more immediate to just change reality, like a tiny, tiny bit. And you see this more and more, like Welbeck, who obviously looms over Dragon Day, and this book, you know, has done this. And I don't know, maybe the character usually has a different name, and certainly in The Map and the Territory, it is Michel Welbeck, who gets murdered, which is kind of a not to magician revealing his secrets, you know, writer revealing his sources, but that moment in Map and the Territory, I don't think you've read it, Robert, but maybe some people listening have, you know, where there's a Michel Welbeck ends up murdered. I mean, that is basically what inspired me to do that. The Map and the Territory. I can lend it to you next I see you.
I don't think I've read that.
But I think it's a purposeful choice based on just the realities, you know, where a lot of writers sort of find themselves in the current year and the current decades that these books have been written, where it's like, well, who am I kidding? Like, I obviously I'm writing about me, and you just, it's fun to make yourself your own character. And like, also, not to go on a tangent with this, I don't even know how interesting this is to most people, but like, we're all on Twitter, you know, we're always kind of fictionalizing not all of us, but many of us are sort of having a halfway fictionalized version of ourselves online anyway. So it's kind of just an extension of that. Because of course, beyond just the name, it is also, it's a character who wrote a book called Dragon Day, I could have written about similar themes in a more fully fictionalized way. But hey, we're in the age of Twitter and people getting their stuff out there. I just wanted to, one and done.
You said you struggled with serial killer OCD and POCD as a teenager, but that,
correct. Yes.
That makes me think of, like, remember the blogger Robert Lindsay used to write about that?
Yeah, I never read Lindsay's stuff on it. Yeah, but let's talk about that, because and then some of the other interviews I've done on that note, a lot of people don't understand that issue unless they've gone through it themselves. However,
I do think, like, we're making light of it, but it is really a serious issue because there's so much stigma. Like, a lot of people really, like, they suffer immensely because they don't even feel, a lot of cases they can't even tell, like, their family, or they can't tell a therapist, because a lot of people who are ignorant about OCD, well, they might actually think maybe the P before OCD and the serial killer, maybe that person actually does have those traits. And people, normies suck and they're ignorant about everything.
They are. Although I'd encourage anyone listening, you know, I just watched this show, Baby Reindeer on Netflix, which some people have probably seen, where there's every episode, it's like, if you or anyone, you know, is in need of, you know, help, call this, you know what I mean? So I'll add my own caveat for your show. If anyone out there has experienced these sort of anxieties that they themselves may turn into a serial killer or be a pedophile or do something horrible, I would encourage you to open up to people. Maybe even, you know, obviously there's a mixed regard for therapists on this corner of the internet, but it probably could help, is what I'm trying to say. Because
there's a lot of nuance, because, like, if someone's just depressed that their life sucks, like, there's major limitations to therapy. But I do think specifically for
OCD, you know,
like OCD, and specifically like paraphilia based OCD, I think that's one area where actually a therapist could really help.
Yeah, because
on the context.
I mean, the science of sort of what it is was always very comforting to me. Now, I haven't really had issues with this in about 10, 15 years, thankfully. Some people it carries into adulthood. For me, it was a teenager thing where I was just utterly convinced that I was going to end up having some kind of sexual sadistic instincts that I wasn't going to be able to control, not based on any that I'd previously had, or I mean, if my own OCD brain at that age. Of course, I looked into every little dark thought I'd ever had, and, you know, sexuality is what it is, and we've all had weird thoughts, whatever, but like, I would just pick up those things. I was really convinced that I'd have this and that it would destroy my life, that I was an untouchable monster because of it, for a few years. And what was kind of described to me by people who understand the psychology of it is that these instincts are really fundamentally rooted in a sense of disgust about these kinds of issues. And then it's this creeping anxiety, like, you know, just, I think it's a thing with OCD in general. And I know, Robert, you struggle with this much more than me, although I think I do have a touch of OCD, to be honest. It's like, not even just with POCD or serial killer OCD, but OCD in general. It's like, it's always like you imagine the worst shit possible. And then
you play out, like, you have worries, but you keep playing out the worst case scenarios.
Yes.
That can happen to you over and over in your head.
Which, the worst case scenarios, which always involve you being really directly involved. So it's like, you have that, you're freaked out.
The
by
thing
some,
is a lot of, a lot of OCD is about, like, fears, but, like, the POCD and serial killer OCD, like, there's some sense those people, like, it's different because they might, there's like an element of guilt, you could say a false guilt, that they feel guilty for something that they have absolutely nothing to do with, and they sort of like convince themselves, almost like they gaslight themselves.
Yeah, you gaslight yourself that it's real. And then, and this is something that also in a sort of scientific way that was explained to me about what's it called? About anxiety in general, including these kinds of OCDs, is like anxiety gives you a very physical feeling in your body. And, you know, we really, I sound like some like lib therapist here, but whatever, you know, we really trust, right? Like the feelings we get in our body. So if you have this
it's an old center show, not a radical center show, not a right wing show.
This is true. This is true. So yeah.
I mean, I think we'll get to that. We might talk about this later, but this is like one area where a lot of things suck about like liberal therapeutic culture. But a lot of the same time, like right wing people would be very close minded about these subject matters. Like a right, like your typical like 90, 85, 90 IQ right winger would see you like, what's POCD? That it's, we need a wood chipper for him.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So no, yeah, there. We can get into the right left thing too, but just basically what I was trying to say is like when you have an anxiety that's very bodily, like you're immediately convinced that it's real. If that makes sense, you know, it becomes a self-fulfilling thing. Like the condition of having some degree of OCD is like you feel the thing,
gets almost,
and it gets worse. Yeah,
like paranoia almost.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like
absolutely.
It veers into the psych. I mean, it's a neurotic disorder, but neurosis always can veer into the psychotic.
Yeah, I mean, I never approached like psychosis, but like definitely it was crippling anxiety, like biggest problem in my life. Level of anxiety at a certain age, and it's gotten better for me, or it got better a long time ago, but I still have, I would say, like my existence is still predicated upon sort of fighting a low level anxiety that something in my life is fundamentally wrong, like that actually persists. And to tie into the religious themes, there's a kind of Gnosticism about that, isn't there?
Yeah, like you sense that subconsciously. You feel subconsciously that something is wrong. You can't identify what it is. That could be Gnostic, yeah, or Buddhist.
Yeah, I mean, and it doesn't have to be. We could split hairs over what things are psychological realities, what things are metaphysical realities. But the point is, whether they are or not, they all kind of feel the same way. And we're some of us at least are fighting through them, which the project of the book, The Black Album, for me is, and the project of my life in so many ways, it is about sort of fighting through that.
What did you make of Netflix's Dahmer?
I love Dahmer. You know, there's a lot of people, Jack, from the Perfume Nationalist, who really hammer on that the sort of woke BLM angle is terrible. And it is.
But it's sort of, I didn't really take offense to it. I just thought they were telling the story because the reality, it was racialized.
Yeah.
When it wasn't really about race. And I think they just sort of told the story. But even the woke stuff, it's so over-the-top satirical.
It was almost funny.
I thought it was almost funny, but I thought it was excellent. But the weird thing is it actually makes Dahmer, like, he comes across
sympathetic.
Because it is very, like, you see the shocking, like, depravity of, like, his crimes, but then it depicts him as pretty sympathetic and likable, actually.
Yeah, this sort of isolated loner with his own private interests, which I think you and I both, Robert, are. So that was from the origins of my POCD, my serial killer OCD, was realizing that I, like some of these people, was also a weirdo, as it were, or an outsider to an extent.
And
I celebrate that.
When in reality, those types of people are in real life, like they're more likely to be totally harmless. But Dahmer is like one case where it kind of vindicates where society maybe, like, it chooses to maybe demonize those types of people more than the people who actually are dangerous. And Dahmer is someone who's used to kind of justify that narrative.
Well, that's, of course, the unpleasant truth, is that, like, even though...
that kind of quiet, eccentric loner, that person is either the potential serial killer, like mass shooter or pedo.
Yeah, and no one should be mistreated because of that. And I'm, again, I stand by it. If anyone has these POCD type feelings, like, it's good to talk about and open up about them. It's helpful. That being said, like, we'd be wrong if we said that there's that it isn't a type. You know what I mean? Like, yes, there is an extent to which outsiders get demonized, and actually more extroverted people can be really bad too. A lot of serial killers are very extroverted, but, like, yes, there are Jeffrey Dahmers in the world, and that's just a fact that we have to recognize.
Yeah,
it's no reason to have POCD, but, like, yeah, obviously it's true. Like, I do see myself in Dahmer a little bit, the same way, you know, there's personality traits that you could say are in common with all sorts of people, with Hitler, you know, many, but, you know, like, you can always,
like, the
find
meme,
yeah,
like, you know, the meme, like, the one thing I'm trying to think what it was, or Mussolini, the Chad Mussolini versus the incel Hitler. Hitler had elements of being this kind of, he's depicted, which is, like, it's weird because he had to be pretty charismatic to rise up to power, but Hitler was, like, depicted as this weird kind of eccentric loner, that archetype. And then again, like, that's used.
And obviously Elliot Rodger was that.
Obviously,
you know?
Elliot Rodger was, like, the quintessential of that archetype.
It's a real thing, but what you have to do if you're experiencing some kind of, you know,
I guess you're saying
OCD,
with the OCD,
yeah, mass
stuff
OCD.
Is you end up taking those stereotypes and you end up, like, gaslighting your, kind
you
of
end
gaslighting
up gaslighting yourself.
Yourself,
and it's just, at the end of the day, you have, you know, you have authority over your own life, and you're, you know, you're only, you can put your outsiderness and your weirdness to good use. You don't have to do anything destructive, and of course there are, but, you know, there are people who seem to be overtaken by these demons, and that's horrifying. But, you know, at the end of the day, we all have agency over our own lives. It's hard to know exactly where that begins and ends, but at the end of the day, I just think people with POCD, with serial killer OCD, should open up about it to a trusted individual, and, like, you're going to be fine. But that being said, you know, there is a reason why we see ourselves in some of these figures. It's funny you bring up Dahmer. I think Dahmer's maybe name dropped once in the book, but Dahmer was a huge part of my serial killer OCD, because he seemed like such a nice and otherwise a normal guy. So it was a hugely relevant. In fact, and maybe this is the line in the book. I think the last gasp of it for me was I watched this really in depth. This was 2011 or something. Watched, like, a really in depth, you know, psychological portrait of Dahmer, and it really scared me. But it was like this weird, like, fear factor thing of, like, exposing yourself to the exact truth about something, which may really scare you, because it's like there are all these things, you know, I'm psychologically weird myself, whatever. But once you kind of get through the worst of it, once you really swallow the pill, well, then you can start to make some improvements. And I found that in my life at, like, 16 17 15 16.
So you talk about, like, your experience of Boy Scouts and the example of the decline in all male environments, how male energy is suppressed, like the longhouse stifling the energy, which is a Baptist theme.
Yeah.
How violence is also absent from modern lives of the middle class, and there's a state monopoly on violence. You talk about your more on your adolescent trauma and what it was like being a gay emo, and, like, then Tumblr.
I'm not gay, to be
as
clear.
Sort of like a proto woke culture. Well, I guess, like, I have a certain friend who I won't name. He would say that about anyone who was emo, but any.
Would gay if you were emo, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, look, you know.
Why did you become an emo? Like, what? I guess I have to say this because I have this friend who's, like, he's totally private. He has no online persona, but he keeps bugging me to ask about this. So, like, why become an emo? Like, what's the significance of that archetype?
No comment. What's the significance of that archetype? I mean, I appreciate the question, because it's relevant to this book. And,
I think,
and maybe,
the specific, it was this emo culture. I think that was, like, big around 2008.
You sure was. Yeah. Emo culture, to go over it, emotional hardcore, melodic hardcore, came out of the hardcore punk scene, was originally, like, an indie type of genre that was mostly, like, adult hipster fans who maybe listened to Weezer and stuff like that, and wore big glasses, pretty tame hipster adjacent thing. In and around, I don't know, 2003, 2004, it became this much more mall prepackaged subculture, kind of fused with goth, and then scene kids were a whole nother thing. I don't exactly know why these things happened, but yeah, 2003, 2004 started to really become sort of emo with crazy peacock hair thing, you know, dyed black, skinny jeans that we know today. And by 2008, 2009, the time I was in eighth and ninth grade, it had really exploded so that every middle and high school in America, not to mention every mall, you could find a few emo
like
kids.
Hot Topic?
Hot Topic. Yeah, probably Hot Topic had something to do with it, of course. And MTV promoting The Used and My Chemical Romance, some of these other bands. You know, it was kind of a, you know, I think these, I don't think it's people who literally thought there's going to be this new subculture for youth, but it came together. You know, I'm kind of proto emo.
Well, it's kind of proto hipster.
Actually, it's more like, not to get split in hairs, it's more like simultaneous with millennial hipster culture. It was just younger people. You know, millennial hipster culture was going on in Brooklyn. It was like, you know, college educated liberal arts school people who liked indie music. And then, but like a lot of them maybe as a teenager would have been emo. And this was the case with me. I was to some extent part of, you know, participated in millennial hipsterdom later on. So it's, there's a emo to hipster pipeline for sure. So the significance of it, okay, for me, I, as sort of talked about in the book, like I was in, and I did an interview with Constantine Hoffmeister that I was confused by this because I don't think they have any equivalent in Germany, but I was basically homeschooled for most of my life. And then
homeschooling is illegal in Germany.
Correct. Yeah. And then I was cyber schooled, which is, you know, same but different. It's, you know, taking school online, basically what everyone had to do during the pandemic. But this was 10 years before it was remotely normal. And maybe it would have happened whether or not I was homeschooled. But I you know, I hit an age I started to like girls, to be clear, did start to like girls. Not all emos are gay, whatever. And I had flirted with being like a skate.
So,
and this
so
is a common enough
so
story, right? Like
you're just bi.
No. I'm not going to put a label on it here, but I'm basically straight. But I mean, there's stuff in the book about if people want to answer those questions. They can read my work. I think it expounds upon that a little bit, where it's like, I think I described it as not a clean bill of heterosexuality or something, but for intents and purposes, basically straight. Is how I describe myself. Anyway, you know, I went through like a skater phase. I even tried, you know, maybe to be a jock, and it just didn't work out. And the kids weren't cool. I couldn't skate very well. Kids were mean to me. Blah 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 blah. And at some point, it's like, well, it's a, you know, Nietzsche. It's such a silly example of this. But I connected reading Nietzsche at a young age, and I remember talking about this thing, the drive to distinction. It's like you can really see this even in a high school. The drive to distinction. You have to have a thing. And for me, I'd seen Spider-Man 3, which is a pretty shite movie, but you know, the Peter Parker character kind of goes emo in that movie. And I was like, this guy looks kind of cool. And like, girls seem to like guys. Some girls seem to like guys who are like this. And then, of course, I more genuinely got into the music. And me being me,
also,
it's
an extension of like the goths from like the 90s.
Absolutely is. You know, it's again, emo being more of this American punk lineage, but it fused with like Robert Smith goth culture too. And yeah, me being me, I took it pretty far. I mean, there's a pic, I'm not sure if it's Googleable, but there's a picture of me kicking around online, you know, looking fully emo with the hair and everything. I'm working on another, you know, written auto fiction sort of, or really just honestly memoir type piece, about it where I go more in depth. But yeah, I took the emo thing pretty far for a good number of years, and was fully enmeshed in that. But, so that's the origin of it for me, and I think that's probably the case for a lot of people. To the extent that there's weird homosexual themes in my writing, in my life, they actually have nothing to do with that period. That's the period that I had my first girlfriend and whatnot. It was actually pretty straight-coded.
So you have like this time spent dwelling on your life of how it could have been and how the world ideally should be.
Yeah.
Like your youthful erotic energy failed to bloom. And then you write about this, but you're not necessarily like incel or neat, but it's more like stand still kind of like middle class normie malaise. So like you write, you have personal issues, but you emphasize that you're like, you're a normie with an office job and a productive member of society, but also that you've kind of like, had broken dreams, like you dreamt of being like a young Bret Easton Ellis. It's not even
sure.
True. So it's like, I don't know if it, you want to even say it's like the true despair of alienation, depending.
No,
like,
it's not. Yeah. It's not. My life's pretty good. And even the character in the book who is made to be a little more dramatic, his life is pretty good.
So it's one character throughout the book?
Because
I read it.
All right, if we're going down, I did this to myself writing a book where it's like kind of multiple characters based on me and then some nonfiction. People are going to be confused. It's going to probably chase me around the rest of my life now because I have it out there. Whatever. But if we're going there, I would say that the character in the email story, the Y and Z story that starts the book, and the character in the obvious story that sort of continues that. That's the last fictional piece. The stories are called Possession and Depossession. Those are the same character. And then the character in My Saturn Return, which is the second story, and the character in the Matt Pegas that is referenced in Palm Springs for religious reasons. Those are the same character. So there's like, yeah, I mean, fuck, sorry, this is so confusing. You know, we can, maybe I should have done it this way, but there's two pairs of stories which each connect, which don't necessarily meet in the middle. And then like Funky Town is its own thing. And then the stuff about the podcaster, which is a little
you
bit
also have
you,
some
Robert,
fiction.
Also
you have some fiction.
Yeah, some nonfiction. Right. So I did
nonfiction.
It to myself. People are going to have different interpretations of it. I think I'm at peace with it, but I do apologize for any confusion that may answer. Because the timelines would get screwy. I mean, like the character, the voice of Funky Town is like a much younger person, and it's a little all over the map with regard to that. But hey, I mean, we're working in this. Another sort of influence on this book, just or that would open my mind. Like, you can just write a book like this if you want. Is Mike Ma's work, and I mean, that shit flits between, you know, obviously personal thoughts and like fictional scenarios all the time. So that's kind of the tradition that's coming out of it, I guess.
So the story, like, between Z and Y, the background is like, you were so this is actually based on a real story. So you were concerned he was take your postings too seriously and influencing him towards doing something bad and you getting blamed for it. So you respect the privacy and not anonymity, but I basically know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
And you got his permission for that and you just kept it anonymous. But I know the background story for this, but he had like interest in more left-hand path occult stuff than actually like radical politics and interest like Crowley and Gnosticism. But I think he said like he thought that you wanted to create an underground radical political movement in California.
if
you just want to give like some background information on this story, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. No, basically it's based on a real incident where I, you know, you never know who's going to be reading your stuff and how they're going to take it. And
I think it's pretty normal. I'm not even that big online, so it's weird that it happened so early to me, I guess. But I think if you're putting your stuff out there, you're going to attract some people like this. And who, you know, not everyone has perfect mental health. So there's going to be times when they lapse into maybe thinking some really crazy things. You enter into their own paranoid. Yeah.
Again, it's obviously anonymous, but we've actually met this person IRL.
It's true. Yeah, we'll keep it at that. But yeah, and he's doing better now, seemingly. The reason I put it in the book, and I would never have done it without getting his permission, it's just because it was a really influential event in my life, kind of in my understanding of my own views and my behavior online and how it can affect people. How to put this? The notion that, again, what is metaphysical and what is explicable just in terms of psychology and mental health? It's chicken or the egg, you know. When this was happening, it felt like something dark was going on to me, that, you know, I'd conjured up something in someone's mind inadvertently, and that it was going to lead to a dark conclusion of him hurting himself or someone else. And I think there's a powerful lesson in that. Not that people shouldn't continue to say things online, not that it's always their fault how their ideas are taken, but simply that on a small scale, you know, we were talking earlier a little bit about the connections between certain kind of creative outsider types with real world sowers of destruction and chaos. And I mean, I think this is sort of how it works. The seeds are planted
and then it takes, the seeds are, the kindling is there, and then it takes a spark, and then you have a fire. I felt like I'd put some kindling up that was catching a spark, and I was afraid that there was going to be some kind of small or large fire, and that is the power of ideas, in short, and even ideas that you can put out there or play with without intending them to be anything but thought experiments or something. You never know.
Then there's a follow-up story with Z and Y, and the first part's real, but the latter part is fiction. So the
there's actually a fictional story
that involves a fictional alt-right New Age podcaster.
Yeah.
And then the story is about you going up to meet him in the barrier. So if you want to kind of explain the inspiration for the fictional story, I think you even referenced like a character based on Pillator.
Yeah, you and Pillator are kind of both fiction. Pillator maybe more directly. Again, not moving, you know, one can write total fiction or one can take these interesting, fascinating characters they met in their life. And you know, as long as I've known Pillator, as long as I've known you, and I even took some of your stories, Robert, I think with your permission, and put them in about involving, we won't even necessarily get into it, but involving certain substances, certain conferences, certain weird happenings that to me are ironic but funny. You know, they make their way in. It's just because I, you know, as like a writer, I'm always taking things, right, and things that I've heard and things that I think throw the weird sort of political chaos behind things in a different light. I mean, for the most part, you know, even though this, the email story and then the follow-up story are about like sort of dissident right ideas gone bad. And we've seen that in the real world. Don't even need to name the names, but you know, of really bad things that have happened because of online politics. Right. For the most part, I still see it as just normal. Like, you know, you see this sometimes, like everyone I meet, most of the people that I meet from the internet are like really cool, and anything that seems weird or off-putting is usually much less marked in person, and a lot of them are like great guys just trying to figure out the world, and there's a lot of funny stories, and I guess I wanted to put something of that in there too, like that I affirm this, all that, you know, may you live in interesting times.
The whole interaction was kind of resolved and ended up on a positive light.
Totally. For me, that interaction ended on a positive light. And that's, I come out very affirmative about all this, even though it's the Black Album, and even though there's a lot of dark stuff that is being worked through. And I wouldn't say the book quite has a happy ending. It's still, we'll see. Maybe I'll have a hard time reading it one day because it still captures dark things and purposely so. But it doesn't, and you know, there's a lot. I got a nice blurb from Brad Kelly of Art of Darkness podcast. I don't have his blurb memorized or anything, but something like, you know, try to alchemize these dark elements just enough to see the light at the end of the tunnel, and that's kind of how I feel about the book.
You republish your Renaissance of the Ritual essay, so the ritual of the mantra as a will to power, channeling energy through the ritual, accessing one's divine will. You talk about arts, religion, this ritual, the foundational mysticism. You reference Mike Ma's idea of foundational mysticism in his book,
yeah,
Gothic Violence. You also talk about BAP and how traditions become stagnant and the problems, how traditionalism is LARPing, and how you call for foundational thinking over traditional. So I guess if you want to kind of explain what foundational thinking is and how it's more dynamic to traditionalism, because traditionalism is pretty much LARPing.
Yeah, you know, it's one of these things. I'm proud of that essay, and I don't regret anything from that essay. You know, you catch me in a certain mood, I'm like, I don't know, like, am I really standing against tradition? And really, do I really have something to offer in the way of something new? I don't know. I'm just one person.
How would you describe foundational thinking?
I would describe it as sort of a trying to find the beauty and the mystery and the wonder in reality on your own, in short, based on, and for me this is synonymous with what occultism has been for me,
finding God and finding that charm in the world on your own. I mean, there's a lot of people online, yes, who embrace traditional religious, you know, traditionalist religion for sort of personal reasons, like we need some kind of structure to answer these questions about why we're here and what we should do and even fuel our politics with that godly fire. And the reason I'm getting a little sheepish is because, like, I don't want to be the guy who's telling you not to do that. I think there's a lot of reasons to do that and a lot of wisdom in it. But for a lot of us, for a variety of reasons, maybe that is not as accessible or seems like a LARP, or we can't quite do it. And for that, I mean, I do think I have found it necessary to sort of find my own ways to pray, find my own ways to connect to the divine.
Foundational thinking, it's getting more in touch with, like, your intuition.
Getting more in touch with your intuition. And as the article even goes into, I don't think this is necessarily at odds with embracing traditional religion. I just think it's also a necessary step in our oh-so sort of demystified world, is that getting in touch with that is good and necessary. Again, not necessarily at odds with being of a traditional stripe. The reason I'm also being a little sheepish about this is because, like, yes. So another theme in the book that's a little understated is, you know, they have a painting at the front, which I saw at the Getty Center, of an alchemist sort of, it was painted in the 1600s and alchemy was losing its favor. Like, everyone was like, well, this stuff's pretty much bullshit. And, you know, the alchemist looks tired and unsuccessful. There's an extent to which this book for me is also like, I've dabbled in some of these, you know, occult things and even alchemy in its own way. And I'm not saying that, you know, when I did a podcast about this book with Evan,
you've gotten anything really profound out of it.
No, I think I've gotten a lot. I think it's been a necessary, you know, a worthwhile step in my personal development, but I don't think I'm there yet. I'm far from enlightened, is how I say. So even though I say all of these things and offer some wisdom and sort of all I can do is offer a portrait of my own thought processes, and they've instilled my worldview with meaning, certainly, but also, like, I'm not there yet, and maybe I will be one day, you know. I'd like to think that
other
there'll be
themes,
yeah.
Could include ascetics as a form of theurgy, the idea of the personal true will that must be uncovered, which relates to Crowley and Nietzsche, magic as the art of bending reality to one's will, psychological alchemy, which is kind of similar to New Thought, which you don't actually reference New Thought, but
not
you sort of
name,
inadvertently,
but
also even Colin Wilson's view about mysticism as changing perceptions of consciousness, and then the role of alchemy, interpretations on alchemy. So alchemy could be, like, yeah, like the Colin Wilson view of changing perceptions of consciousness. It could be psychological or spiritual. It could be like ascetics, using ascetics as theurgy, but alchemy could also be something like transhumanism, bioengineering, eugenics or ethnogenesis, or even like 3D printers. Those are all forms of alchemy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, like, again, part of my occult take on things. Like, it's stuff you can find in pretty obvious realities.
Because people say alchemy is bullshit, but isn't, like, these proposals for artificial meat? That's totally alchemy.
That's totally alchemy, and that's less my purview. But, like, yes, that's alchemy. And then also psychological alchemy, like the role of the process of Negrito, of, you know, reducing everything to a black base and making gold out of shit, or gold out of lead or whatever. Like, this is something that I think all creative people, all artists are engaged in, is taking the dark stuffs of life and turning into something wonderful. So, like, I think that, you know, lately I've been thinking, like, alchemy as well as Kabbalah and a lot of these other, some of these other Hermetic traditions, we're kind of like, not that I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Freudian psychoanalysis guy either, but, you know, I think there's some truth to that stuff. I kind of view a lot of Kabbalah in many ways, especially, but also alchemy is,
well,
like...
Well, I mean, you mean like uncovering, like, what is in the hidden unconscious?
Yeah, I kind of view them as, like, early attempts at psychology in a weird way. Like, before there was psychology, there were these religious and even pseudoscientific endeavors that actually mirror they mirror something. Like, it's a kind of the case, speaking of psychoanalysis, like, most of what Freud said was not literally true either, but a lot of, he's influenced a lot of artists. It's because, you know, maybe it's not the scientific truth, but like the Oedipal complex, these kinds of things, you know, and Freud was finding it in early artistic works as well. It's like these processes, these narratives have this incredible power. Why? Because they're somehow pre-programmed in our brains to represent something, if not a measurable truth, then some psychological dance that we all do throughout our lives, and with tarot as well, which is hugely interesting.
Yeah, you have a big interest in tarot.
Yeah,
and you view tarot and mysticism as the solution to alienation. Do you think tarot
one solution? maybe a very wrong-headed solution, but a solution that I have experience with. Yeah,
actually works. Have you got anything out of it, or do you think tarot is a cope?
I think this is a microcosm of the bigger question about esotericism, mysticism in general. I think that there is something real about it, and that it charts something, and that by studying it, you gain more and more psychological insight, and even cultural insight, collective unconscious, sort of Jungian insight into the way things sort of work, and some kind of forces that are behind things. In terms of working for personal transformation, real divination, the highest promises of these crafts, I cannot say that I have achieved immense success with it yet. I hope that makes sense. I just think,
yeah,
with all these things, and another, maybe the most, and this is also a reference, one of the most efficacious, and I do consider this to be occult or esoteric adjacent, is yoga. I've had great kind of results with, in terms of easing the mind, at least doing breath work in certain ways that gets you to a certain state. I've had incredible success with, but I don't yet know sort of where all that goes, if that makes sense. Like some people, you know, in the Hindu tradition, you do yoga and it brings you closer to God. I mean, I've certainly felt that. But I don't know if my image of God and sort of these other super egoic elements, like what I really want out of life and what God really wants of me, these questions I struggle with as much as I ever have. But there's definitely something real within these different esoteric schools I've dabbled in. I just don't yet know. It's like I don't know what to do with some of the insights I've had yet, is kind of how I feel. And I'm sorry if this is, meandering, whatever. I'm just not going to pretend like, oh, I have the answers, because I really don't. Delve into esotericism and occult at your own risk. It's, frowned upon within certain traditions, probably for good reason. But like, it definitely corresponds to stuff that is real on a psychological and perhaps metaphysical plane. I'm just not sure. I have the lead, I have the ingredients, but I'm not sure sort of how to best use them as of yet.
You have an article in the Black Album, David Lynch, Inner Freedom. David Lynch on finding inner freedom. So be unfreedom, you talk about it in metaphysical terms rather than like physical terms, and like a very Gnostic or Buddhist theme. And you reference transcendental meditation as like the selling point is to be creative and to discovery in the subconscious. You've practiced, I guess the question is like how to break free from the simulation. So have you experienced anything like profound from transcendental meditation? And what would you say is the way to break free from the simulation?
Yeah. Again, kind of a little bit of a microcosm about all this. And this is stuff that this is not me retrospect, because, I did finish writing this about a year ago. So it is a little bit past tense. But also, like, even within the article, I say, like, my experiences of TM have been nowhere near as profound as David Lynch's. David Lynch writes in Catching the Big Fish, as well as his longer book, Room to Dream, I think it's called, his autobiography about how his first time doing TM, he was just floored. Like, he experienced bliss from the get-go. And there's a lot of hucksters out there. There's a lot of new age hucksters. We all know it. I don't think Lynch is that. Like, I believe him. I believe that he totally experienced TM that way. I've met people who, maybe Lynch's is the most compelling story of all, and that's why he's the biggest spokesperson of it. But I've met other people who've said great things about it. For me,
it's kind of just helped in this meat and potatoes way. Like, yeah, meditating is good. I don't know if I've seen the face of God. I don't know if I've seen the what Lynch describes as like this bliss that lies behind things. Haven't experienced it myself. But I've tried, and I don't regret trying. Sorry, what was the question beyond that? Like, breaking out of the simulation. I mean that breaking out of the simulation is, I think, a little easier. I think there's, you know, I think anyone listening to this podcast has probably just to a large extent broken out of the simulation. I mean, I think that anyone who, you know, it's the light side, I guess, of some of this dissatisfaction some of us have with life and society.
So were to channel like this drive, and you could channel it for the arts, how to bring order to chaos. So like the Apollonian via like the arts and the science is one example, but like the tension between creativity and like family or work life and material things get in the way. And politics can also take on like the role of the will to fight. But then there's also like there's escapism, but you actually kind of like talk hypothetically about secret societies or like a right wing new age movement.
Yeah.
There's
a lot like, of
you say a base Marian Williamson Baptist version of Steiner schools.
Yeah, that was a section that wasn't in the original article, so that's a little, you know, original to the book.
So this element. Was like, original article that you changed for the book.
Yeah, I had a longer. I wrote it for this no longer existent little startup sort of publication called the LA Biweekly that our friend Sean was putting together. Didn't go that far, but this was for that. It was kind of for a more general audience, and then I had these other thoughts that are more part for the course with what's in the rest of the book. Little thought experiments, lots thrown at the wall, you know, that's where my fictional writing and nonfiction starts to merge. I like thought experiments. I like there's a lot of ideas that to me seem like it would be interesting if someone did this. You know, Baptist Steiner schools, whatever, based Marianne Williamson. I'm not the guy to do that, but I like throwing these ideas around, and sometimes maybe it's in fiction, or sometimes maybe it's as an.
I mean, Steiner schools are already getting targets of cancel culture.
Yeah, I know it. I don't know. I'm not an expert on Steiner and Steiner schools, but this is a sidebar. Doesn't go too far in the Black Album.
But from what I've heard, they've been extreme. Their approach is extremely successful.
Extremely successful. And I would say, you know, in this society, it's so hard, you know, to really break through to the mainstream. You know, RFK is not going to win the presidency. You know, Trump sort of disrupted. You know, we have these disruptors, but like there's so much that's shut down. You know, it's so hard to really change things in a meaningful way, or seems to be right now. If there's one thing that I do find interesting, it's, and I'm not going into this in my personal life, but like education, like there, I do think, you know, education in this country is so, so broken. The public school system, it certainly where I live, but really it seems to be a pandemic. You know, it really seems to be an issue across the country. The state of education is so, so poor. It seems like finding a new way, to educate children in a more holistic way could be one step towards building a better world, right? Man, that is not a task that I personally am up for, but it would be an interesting, you know, an interesting place to start. I think I even referenced this in the article, Curtis Yarvin criticizing Christopher Rufo, like, you know, you're anti-woke, but like, what are you suggesting you replace it with?
Darvin doesn't have the solutions either. Like, Yarvin's much more intelligent than Rufo, but neither of them, they both are basically critics, but neither of them offer really any solutions.
Yeah, because, and I don't fully blame them for that, because where do you even start offering a solution? If you're offering a solution without money and without a lot of infrastructure, you know, you're just engaging in thought experiments yourself, and people are going to look at you as hokey, but, I don't know, like some kind of, you know, I say like a better kind of more Steiner or holistic form of education would be good, but there's almost a more predominant, like that, maybe that could be it. Yeah, I think you'd have, yeah, maybe charter schools and private schools would be the way to go about that. Or homeschool groups, even.
Like homeschooling co-ops, even.
Yeah, something like that. But then it's like, how do you get all those people on the same page? Well, you do need some kind of organization for that. That's why, you know, the best equivalent of this would be religious schooling, which is great, right? But then, you know, there's compromises within
the Catholic Church, within, you know, Jewish organizations. You know, all of these groups are not quite, you know, I like Steiner more is what I'm trying to say, but how many people are sending their kids to Steiner schools, and what would the equivalent of that be? The question isn't just, you know, how should we educate kids? It's also how should we organize, you know, what do we believe in as a people? And this is, there's a lot of breakdown with regard to that question. People aren't on the same page.
How does Lynch relate with Bapp's whole concept about the need to control space?
Good question. I tie in Lynch's love of transcendental meditation with some select, you know, always very influential on me sections of Bronze Age mindset about the Buddha and Buddhism, which Bapp speaks very, very highly of, and Buddhist meditation as like a sort of way to recapture. This is just one theory, and a lot of, you know, a lot of people have been talking recently, like Bapp, you know, cherry picks history, which maybe, but it's still a worthwhile thought experiment, at least. This idea that Buddhism, I think you could probably make some more arguments about Gnosticism, and Bapp kind of does, like that these, you know, strange life-denying, seemingly life-denying religions are actually, you know, like in the case of Buddhism, was a way to continue the culture of the steppe warrior. Again, probably someone out there going to tell me, you know, that's nonsense. But the thought experiment, at least in Bronze Age mindset, is that, you know, the Buddha, you know, and his followers are trying to recapture the spirit of open space that they experience as steppe warriors within the, you know, Bapp has very harsh words for, specifically in East Asia, the squalor and filth of city life, that one could go on an inner journey instead, you know, in lieu of the open plain, to find the vista within. I find something similar in the work of Lynch, and it's not unrelated to his meditation, that he's trying to find this space of total freedom. And Lynch is a man who expresses himself very strangely. Some people even call him an idiot savant. I don't know if that's fair, but, you know, he's not the most eloquent person, but he does talk about freedom. In his book, he talks about freedom. And there's the quote at the beginning of his essay about how he's never really felt free. There's always some kind of demands, whether it's, you know, he's been married.
Remember, like, the
whole
he's
been
concept.
Divorced again. Since this essay was written, you know, he can't, he
yeah,
for some
remember,
reason, he's always getting married.
Yeah. Like the whole concept, I think maybe it was Brandon Adamson who initially said it, but true freedom is not like freedom in a libertarian sense, but it's the freedom to have like a society that's geared towards your own like needs and interests.
Yeah, and that jumps to a more political interpretation, but it's not unrelated. And you kind of gave that to your character of Roger Blackstone. It's like, it's more than just the right to do this and that. It's like, yeah, the freedom to truly create, the freedom to be, I hesitate, but, you know, this is where occult stuff comes at odds with traditional religion, but not necessarily with Bapp, who I think is very occult in his own way. You know, the freedom in some sense to be, I'll say, you know, the bad version is to be a god. You know, the people are reticent about saying I want to be a god, but we can say to be like a god, you know, right? That's what creativity is, to imitate that radical from the ground up creativity is the triumph of the human spirit, and it's very, very hard to come by in the material world. Nay, it's impossible to come by in the material world, but maybe it can be found in art. I don't know. I'm maybe a little less optimistic about that. I'm not here to give a TED talk, but people like Lynch kind of embody a radical kind of freedom in their work. You know, and even lesser known artists, I think, also, you know, art in short is one solution. You know, meditative spirituality could be one solution to the confines of, you know, humdrum middle class life and the decline of the West, however you want to parse.
Reposted the essay Politics of Aesthetics Revisited, and you talk about aesthetic decline, the symbolic shift, how aesthetics represent the symbolic shift of a managed decline or late stage capitalism. The change, like minimalism, is like it conceals wealth and power versus like symbols of power of past aesthetics. Aesthetics is deculturization. How cathedrals are comparable to like older symbols of capitalism. So like neon signage, Las Vegas casinos from old Vegas, to even like the themed resorts of like the 90s, 80s malls, skyscrapers, or like malls as sort of like the 20th century's Gothic cathedrals, like what they took from us meme, the irony taking trad aesthetics and juxtaposing them upon like retrofuturism, malls, 80s and 90s consumerism to weaponize kitchen nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
So like we've talked about this like countless times in some of our earlier shows, which is kind of like, I don't know how much we need to like,
no, but this,
but I do think what's interesting is James Nolick said he grew up in the 80s, but he never really appreciated it that much. And he said he described it as being nostalgic for like the satanic architecture of it that he took for granted as a young man, like malls and arcades.
Yeah.
He called it satanic, actually.
Yeah. Was he talking about Vegas or like, yeah, he has obviously a mixed take on some of the aesthetics, but
it's interesting, like those.
No, I think he called,
remember
I,
we were
I
filming
he,
at like West Side Pavilion, like a lot of those 80s malls use kind of like Masonic or occultist themes. Like, remember that portal we filmed at West Side Pavilion for whatever, maybe it was Supply, I forget what we used it for, but it had
it was for Supply,
the pyramid, like a pyramid over like the entrance to like the. Like there was an escalator that goes up to the top rooftop parking, and there's these two columns like holding up a pyramid that feel very kind of occultist.
Like the Temple of Solomon or something.
Right.
To be clear, and I may have to go and check, I think Nolick was describing modern minimalist architecture as satanic, perhaps, and he was speaking
maybe.
More positively.
Oh,
I think that's what it was, because he was also positive about it.
Okay.
It's kind of hard. It's weirdly hard to unpack exactly what's... I think that essay may be one of my sort of better ones kind of philosophically, because I think I make a fairly sophisticated point that I've not always been able to replicate in conversation. I think it's worth it. I was on Constantine von Hofmeister's podcast the other day, and I was maybe a little underslept, but he was asking about this, and I'm dreading listening back because I don't think I explained it that well. But basically, and you're right. I don't want to rehash all here, especially because I don't think I'll do a good job. And you can, you know, Robert, of course, this essay was heavily influenced by you. It was influenced by the Alt of Center blog that is also referenced in the first story and that we've talked about so many times. It was written, it's the last essay in the Black Album, but it was the first essay written in 2020. And it kind of was, even then, was like taking ideas that I'd already talked about in 2018, 2017, 2018, and kind of updating them for that year to try and understand them as I was getting, you know, more in depth in my thinking and becoming a slightly better writer. But yeah, I mean, I hate such a cop out, but rather than me bastardizing the point, I think that's a good essay. If you're not going to read anything else in the book, maybe if these themes are of interest, do check that piece out. Because I think it sums up a lot of the first couple years of my insights online up, you know, in line with a lot of stuff we've talked about on your show, as you've talked about, Robert, about the significance of
pitch. It's interesting
because
Las Vegas is another major theme in the book and the significance. So, but I think like that's referenced in at least one of the stories, maybe more, but like Vegas once, like what Vegas represented, I think it once represented freedom and adventure, but it's now very much, it is a controlled, it is very much a controlled environment, as Bap would say, but it makes me think of like the famous story by Ray Bradbury about like, where he wrote about like this 80s mall about, he called it like a place to get lost safely.
Right,
like, minimizes Vegas. But you say we're all chaos magicians in Vegas, and you playing the slots and gamble, like that's a form of alchemy. Spinning the wheel is an important metaphor for life, but it's because it's futile and it's like masturbation. But also the feelings about Vegas, like
the
I
house
feel
always
the same,
wins. It's really all
same
I
way,
that.
Like the first few times you go, and like I feel I still like going, but there's not the same magic or allure. And you write about feeling depressed in Vegas, like a sense of emptiness. But then there's not the same magic or allure of like the first trips. And that also could be because of age. But that applies to a lot of places. Like I haven't gone to Disneyland since I was in high school. But obviously like as a kid, like that was maybe like a magical place to go. And then as a young adult, like in my 20s, it was Vegas, and you don't feel the same like allure. But But no, you did say something interesting when you went to the Neon Boneyard. You actually found it to be very Apollonian. Well, you find Vegas as a whole to be Dionysian.
Yeah, there's something about the preservation of those neon signs that even though it is a very modern, even postmodern, chaotic force, even just this, the Neon Boneyard, you know, sort of fits my sensibilities, as explained in that last essay, you know, Aesthetics of Politics of Aesthetics is Revisited, in that, like, even though these things are recent and even though these things are a far cry from the Sistine Chapel, at the same time, there was a little bit of that, right? And we can still find,
because Vegas
find something more divine,
temporary,
especially
disposable place.
Yeah. So even
right now, the next one they're gonna like demolish Tropicana.
Yeah. Oh, I think they already did.
Oh, really? And I think they might actually. I heard, what's the Excalibur? Wait, what's the one? The Egyptian pyramid.
Excalibur. No, sorry, Luxor. Yeah, they're gonna
the Luxor. I heard
no way.
That's from the 90s. I heard they might actually demolish that too.
Terrible. I mean, it's not as good as it used to be, but you hate to see it go, you know. It's a more discount rate one, but it's also one of the most amazing ones on the inside. Yeah, these things will not last forever. Hopefully they'll be preserved in some capacity, because this gets into a broader theme that I'm not even sure if I have if I can really explain, but, you know, we've talked about it, you know, in terms of nostalgia. There's something divine within even short-term things that we're nostalgic for. Like, there's always something in memory. Mixtape Hyperborea, Adam Reinspeck's kind of read sort of this too. Like, even in like, when you look back on things, the presence of, I'll just say it religiously, you know, the presence of God and then the presence of the divine is somehow more apparent. So even in something like Vegas, which is so satanic to many people and for good reason, like, there is still something there of man's stretching toward the divine that is easier to see when it's sort of preserved. And
it's definitely like they're going in the, at least like when you first visit it and you arrive at night, there is definitely like a really otherworldly aura. Like the first time you see Vegas at night is pretty, like, I guess you get jaded after going there many times, but like the very first Vegas trip you take and you see it at night is pretty spectacular. It's a pretty amazing experience, like the first time.
Absolutely, it's one you take with you. I mean, we went there for the first time in 2018, and I've had some good trips there since, but it's not ever
the first. The first time I went was 2009, and yeah. I kind of regret not being able to go. Like, I could have gone as a kid in the 90s, like, because I was growing up in LA, but I for some reason, like, my family didn't go. But I guess I do kind of regret not being able to see it back then in the 90s.
Yeah, but, you know, it is still magical. You know, people going for the first time now will still get
there,
a lot.
I think
they're
also going to take down the barrage and put up, like,
oh my god, yeah, that's the one that's going down next, and that's a real shame because that's a beautiful, beautiful casino, and very symbolic of a certain time.
I think that was from like the late 80s.
Yeah, late 80s, early 90s. Yeah, and this brings up an interesting point. I mean, I think that there's something genuinely good in Vegas. And then, that story, which straight up nonfiction, my experience, 15 hours in paradise, it's called.
We stayed, like, our last trip, we stayed at the Rio, and there's a really kind of, there is something really like eerie and kind of hauntology vibe to that place.
Oh yeah. That place is like a dead mall, which I don't hate, but, you know,
there is something. Yeah. It has like a charm to it, but there is something a bit of a, like, it's rumored to be haunted. Like, there is something a bit creepy about like walking around the Rio at night.
It's hard. I don't think it's as haunted as the Luxor.
Luxor, no. But did you get those vibes?
or Mandalay Bay?
There is some. It has a cool kind of like cool aesthetic, sort of 80s, but dead mall. But there is something really eerie about that place.
Eerie, but I find, if we're going to go into paranormal, like, Rio to me is kind of benevolent. I'm not saying, yeah, there's probably ghosts there, but it feels more benevolent than Luxor or Mandalay Bay. But yeah, no, I would agree. I'm going to try and make a more abstract point here. Hopefully it will go over, but that story, you know, it is about like that, the story about Vegas that you're referring to, you know, it is about trying to win gambling. On that particular day, I actually did come out 100 ahead, which for me was better than I've ever done any other time. I think that there is this promise in Las Vegas with the neon lights and the casino stretching towards the heavens. You know, there is something genuinely
good. Oh, you see Prometheus
within that Promethean? And Promethean. Yeah, but then there's also a sick sort of reverse pentacle kind of thing of trying to squeeze blood out of stone, trying to advance herself on the material plane. And that is satanic, sort of even from an esoteric. I'm not saying satanic like, oh, I'm calling this thing I don't understand satanic. I mean, like, literally, that is lower vibrational. So, you know, I think that Vegas is this crazy place where these instincts mix, like wonderful aesthetics mixing with, you know, this drive, the materialistic drives, basically. But then sometimes even the materialistic drives, you can sort of alchemize and you can come out on top. I mean, that happened for me on the particular day that I wrote that story.
Or the other
in
theme,
a way.
Which gets,
but like,
kind of gets in with like Mark Fisher and Hauntology, is it sort of a capitalism is what created Vegas, but like now we're kind of in this like late stage capitalism where capitalism is causing like this, like we're seeing like the decay of civilization.
Yeah. It's this incredible,
and the aesthetics like dual, should show that.
Yeah. Snakes along its own tail sort of thing. And I think it was
Vegas.
Even
though Vegas, like Vegas can never be truly minimalistic because Vegas sort of has to be very flashy, but you do still see this kind of like decline, like a lot of hotels like replacing their old, the animated like bulb signs with more sterile like LED signs and stuff like that.
Yeah, and just technology and even the slot machines. I mean, I guess some of the new ones are sort of cool, but also like with AI and new 3D technologies, like they're only going to get, like, I kind of miss the old ones, you know, like they're, these
like
things,
I think in I think in the future they might just replace all the signage with holograms.
I think they probably will, and like that, those could be cool too. But like something else is lost. I don't know. Vegas is this place. You kind of, I don't usually lose a lot of money in Vegas. I often kind of break even, and that's kind of my overall take on the place. Is it promises a lot. You gain some, you lose some, and you end up kind of breaking even. Maybe you come out a little ahead, and you're really lucky if you do. And I do view that as a sort of metaphor for life in so many ways. The only progress you're going to make is slow, and you have to just put the work in, and oftentimes you're going to be left depleted. And that was kind of a lesson I've been learning in life over the past few years, not just in Las Vegas, but also literally in Las Vegas, is that lesson. And in terms of dabbling in esotericism, like there's this hope, and I do this in the story, and I did it in real life, I'm not ashamed to admit, where you're trying to like manifest cards, like you're trying to see if you can influence things by focusing, which maybe it's idiotic that I even try that, but like there, you know, you dabble a little bit in esotericism and you want to see, right? But the hard truth is, like, no, the house does always win. I don't know, maybe there's some powerful wizard out there that can do something I can't, but for the most part, it's like you have to realize, like, in as far as magic and esotericism are real, you're not going to be able to use it to beat the odds at blackjack, and much less a slot machine. And that's like in a screwed up way that maybe I sound moronic for even saying it, but like that was sort of a hard lesson to fully embrace that the luck that you feel in Vegas, you know, is just that, it's just luck. It's just random. And, I do believe we can influence chaos in our lives. I do. But not when it's that mechanical as it is in Vegas. And I think that's a kind of a broader lesson I've had to learn about life and about esotericism that's kind of on every page of the Black Album, is this desire, this strong desire to transcend that is met with the reality of a kind of chaotic and uncaring and in so many ways meaningless world. I'm still a believer, but, you know, I'm also still on the search.
Yeah.
But all I mean to say is, I think even though that's a piece about Vegas and gambling, it's also deeply related to the themes in some of the short stories, in the painting of the failed alchemist. That's a snapshot of where I was.
It's
and
also
still am in some ways.
It's also important. It's like escapism.
Yeah.
How everything in society is banal. Like, we create places just for escapism, but the problem is like everything is dictated by consumerism and capitalism. Like, we can't create places like that purely for the sake of it.
Yeah, and I think that Vegas is a good example of something where that's like something that's genuinely good, you know, aesthetics, the pure joy of going out there, you know, that is soon, and even like, you know, the joy of maybe you play one hand of blackjack, you win, you got $10, right? It's like genuinely a joyful thing. But then the second it becomes like a cope, you know what I mean? The magic is drained from it. Like the line between things that have a little touch of the divine and things that become a cope or an addiction is really slim. I haven't had to really battle with addiction to learn that, but it's something I found. Like, we're all kind of trying to go back to Eden, down roads of pleasure, and we end up in the ditch over and over again.
You reference like your original Alt Center article, and it's interesting because like that really never, like the Alt Center, Radical Center, like it didn't really take off. And on one hand, like you could say, like a lot of those people, the pessimism is that it doesn't really have the demographic support to go anywhere. It could sort of get absorbed by the energy from like the more Trumpian right,
yeah.
Which obviously that's a whole other topic of like the pros and cons of that, of whether it can steer that in a right direction or whether it will just be totally just kind of brushed aside. And maybe like RFK Jr., I mean, he's not going to win. Obviously, the chance of him winning are extremely slim. But the question, like some things like the relevance of like RFK Jr. to like radical centrism. Then I think like the other theme is like the base Whipple, which we were talking about back in 2018.
Yeah.
And that's sort of that sort of amounts to like Dime Square.
Yeah.
And NRX today kind of encapsulates that. So I guess, would you say is that kind of cringe? But like, where do you like revisiting all these, like this talk of like,
yeah,
of all these things and a lot of the esoteric concepts we came up with, but like revisiting like alt centrism and where do you see it now?
Oh man. Yeah. No, I see it.
I think
as
you said, like,
manifested.
I think on the first show, I introduced you as a former leftist,
which is
alt centrist. Yeah. You were never actually like really that much of a leftist.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, I think people who've listened to this can even tell I'm somewhat, to my discredit, I guess, you know, I'm a little all over the map on certain things. I've certainly dabbled with pretty lefty ideas and did in college. So that's why it wasn't like a lie to say that I was a former leftist on that first podcast, but it was just like a sliver of the truth that seemed to make more sense.
You voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Yeah, I did. But I didn't vote for Bernie. I mean, I didn't even vote for the primary at all. But like, I was more of a non-alt centrist, I guess, is really the answer there.
You were not on the left. You were kind of like almost a more like mainstream centrist.
Yeah, I guess so. I think that the biggest difference between me then and now, because I still am sort of a centrist, I guess, is I just really wanted to believe and did believe more in the system at that time. I hadn't been exposed to enough. I guess my life had been okay enough. I respected certain establishmentarian adults in my life enough to suppose that, like, you know, for all its flaws, you know, the basic American, you know, call it neoliberal, I guess, system was basically good. What's the thing that people always say about democracy and capitalism? The best of, well,
the
of a
least,
lot of bad options.
Best,
which,
yeah,
the
best of a bad option. So did I radicalize you?
Well, yes and no, because your podcast and other people I got, especially your podcast, I do give you credit, exposed me to a host of other ideas. But so did Trump winning in the first place was kind of shattered my worldview and some other things that happened in my life. And just starting to think on my own, you know, I went to a good school. I went to Cornell. I mean, I think that's pretty well known by now, and it's noted by name in the book. So no hiding there, you know. And just getting out of that sort of bubble started to open my mind. But did you radicalize me? No, because in so many weird ways, like if the gun's to my head, yeah, capitalism still is probably the best of a lot of bad options. Sure, there should be certain... I'm not a free market capitalist, but like overall, like, yes. And, you know, with democracy, obviously I respect a lot of more monarchist type opinions. But I'm definitely not in favor of changing American democracy overnight. I mean, the basic wisdom that these are the best of bad options, but I come at it from a more nuanced and different angle from it now. Yeah.
So there's a whole, like the base Whipple theme, there's that, which I guess you can, but that was more my concept, but like you almost see like, Dime Square and sort of epitomizes that, but like part of me feels vindicated, but then part of me feels like that's kind of cringe.
I don't think it's cringe. I mean, nowadays you got to be like, everyone's always going to be like, oh, you like Times Square there, blah, 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 blah. I don't care. Like, there's a lot of good that's come out of that. And, like, yes, it was, we did, I'm not going to give us credit, we didn't meme it into existence. But, you know, we were talking about, you know, hipsters going this way, post Bernie Bros. And, like, yes, these people are now reading Steve Saylor. So, yes, it manifested. It became true. What the biggest difference between what I guess we were sort of hoping for at the time and the reality of it now is there's no candidate for these people. Like, it's not political. It's solely
everything.
Cultural.
I think the success is all, it's all cultural. That's where all the energy is. But, like,
yeah, and I think politics, some of that has to do
politics
with
politics are pretty bleak. Like, I'm saying that even if Trump, there's a good chance Trump will win, like, I'm probably going to support RFK, but I sort of get if people want to support Trump, that's fine. But the whole idea, it's just incredibly kind of foolish and naive to think that there's going to be some cataclysmic political revolutionary change with Trump getting a second term.
Yeah, I agree.
It probably will be chaotic. Who knows what will happen? But it's just there isn't the, or I just don't see like the political organization for any kind of like radical like paradigm.
Yeah,
not
as of yet. No,
like,
go on.
One last thing is I have this article that's like a very, very, I'm just on a really rough kind of like outline stage, but on like radical centrism and dualism. But we're sort of towards the end, so I don't want to go off too much on a whole other.
You can
like,
pitch it though, it's fine.
Tangent.
Yeah.
But it is interesting how, but do you think that's really like the core principle of like, if you want to summarize like what is a radical center, is it, it's basically dualism and sort of taking these ideas, you could even say like things like Jungian or the things we've talked about and transposing them upon politics.
Yeah, like a newly nuanced sort of post-vibe shift center, basically. The reason we were so, I mean, listen, on some level, I'm talking about, like, I was naive when I was an establishmentarian, and I was a lot less naive once I became more nuanced and willing to look at, you know, outside of the
overton
window.
We were sort
of
naive in 2018 about a lot of these
things.
But
we were naive, yeah, we were both younger. But also we were coming off of Trump's victory, which did briefly make it seem like anything could be possible. And that window has shut. Maybe it'll open again, but it's shut for now. So I don't blame us too much. You know, it's the same. It's the same reason why I don't even want to name it. I don't know. It's the same reason why certain people from like the dissident right of that time did sort of stupid things is because it seemed like things were changing quickly. And actually they weren't.
I guess like the example of dualism is, like, you take something like morality and you decide, like, what are absolutes and then what are situational.
Yeah.
Or just different approaches to different issues. Like, you can believe in both egalitarianism, but also believe in hierarchy at the same time. And, like, elitism, you can believe in egalitarianism and elitism at the same time. Like, though, that's just an example. I think, like, I might even, when the article comes out, like,
let's do another pod.
Do like a whole podcast on that.
Sure, yeah, and I'll brush up on my thoughts on it as well. But of course, it's not irrelevant to the book because it's relevant to what I'm talking about in the aesthetics of politics revisited. And one thing that we haven't really addressed is it's relevant to the email story because that was the blog altofcenter.com, my old blog that was referenced in that story. So it's part of my origin story and this book, Black Album. And maybe this is a little bit by
and
way
you also
of conclusion.
In the book,
yeah.
Black Album. You also republish your addendum to Dragon Day.
Yeah.
But if you want to talk about that, but we already dedicated a whole show to that.
Correct. Yeah. And people should just read that. It's a very, I'm very proud of that piece.
But you did say like Dragon Day, you lamented that it's sort of like half lamenting, but also sort of bragging that it's more Welbeck than Mishima.
You're right. Well, that's in again, jouncing around a fiction, nonfiction. That's in the Saturn Return story about how there's like a desire like that you write this narrative confessing elements of your own weakness, which in some ways Dragon Day is, and you hope it'll be sun and steel. You'll emerge of it out of it. The masculine. It's not to, I just remember there was a, remember when you were running Journey to Vapor Island, a certain former co-host of the show wanted you to have Noam kind of come out more masculine or something. And you veered away from that. That's one version of it. Yeah, I just remember hearing that from you a second. That's one version of the narrative, but the reality is a lot of us end up
you know, the same but shittier phenomenon, right? It's like, yes, I've successfully exercised these demons, but I don't come out of it like a warrior because there's really no peace in society for the warrior. Actually, most of our lives are a little more like Welbeck's.
Yeah, so it's Matt, it's been a great show. Thank you so much for being on, and check out the Black Album.
Yes, please do. Thanks so much for having me, Robert. And yeah, it's available on Amazon. I'm sure the links will be abundantly posted with this podcast.